His name is Lyle Pressler, punk rock legend and music industry vet. His name is Jim Shear, most tenured VJ in the history of music television. It's Lyle and Jim, it's the week in music, and it all starts now. Hello everybody, my name is Jim Shear.
And I am Lyle Pressler.
And on today's show, Axl Rose says hello to AC/DC. Brian Johnson says goodbye to AC/DC. Kanye West gets sued. The Black Keys regret doing Steve Miller a solid. Stairway to Heaven goes to court. A mega concert is in the works. Lyle Pressler is partly responsible for the 27th greatest punk rock album of all time. But first, let's talk about Coachella. We're smack dab in between weekend number one and number two. The first weekend.
Oh, actually, I guess so there's another weekend.
Yeah.
Oh, so
same
I'm
lineup,
still not
same
out of
stages.
This. I'm still not. This is not in my rearview mirror.
No.
It's still
yeah,
coming
this
up.
This is a perfect time to talk about Coachella.
Fantastic.
The first weekend seemed to be a success.
Yeah.
Seemingly the only festival that can make moments made moments. AC/DC's Angus Young joined Guns N' Roses, Kesha joined Zedd,
yes.
Lord and Sam Smith joined Disclosure, Bernie Sanders via video introduced the rap group Run the Jewels, Killer Mike a huge Bernie Sanders supporter, Seal was there, Kanye West popped up on stage, Sylvester Stallone made a family weekend out of it, everybody is talking about Sia's performance, and Taylor Swift attended as a fan. So Lyle, two-part question. Is Coachella our premier festival here in the United States? And how come other festivals don't seem to churn out moments in collaborations like this one?
Well, you know, I think the answer to the first question is absolutely. I mean, this is the festival. I mean, you know how I feel about festivals, but this is the one. If you're going to go, and where is Palm Springs?
Indio, California, yeah, just in the shadows of Palm
okay,
Springs.
Okay, so south of Los Angeles.
No, my question is, there are other big festivals. You've got Bonnaroo, you've got Lollapalooza, but since Coachella it really kicks off the festival season, and since L.A. people kind of want to be seen and moments need to be made, I think that's why all of this usually happens at Coachella.
Yeah.
I mean, Lollapalooza happens in August.
Yeah, I think going to Palm Springs in April? Yeah.
And usually Coachella weekend number one has more moments than Coachella weekend number two.
Right, because people are just exhausted.
Yeah, which happens this weekend. So it's been confirmed that Axl Rose, who performed at Coachella, will be the frontman of AC/DC for their 10 makeup dates in the U.S.
You called it.
You got some good practice. Yeah, got some good practice at Coachella. He performed Whole Lotta Rosie and Riff Raff with Angus Young. Curiously, those are two Bon Scott songs. So is this a new Axl, Lyle? I mean, he did the Troubadour show. He's doing AC/DC dates, Guns N' Roses dates, Coachella. He accepted the recovery throne of his former nemesis, Dave Grohl.
Instead of canceling shows,
I mean, he's performing injured.
Yeah.
Old Axl would have canceled the shows.
No, he would. I mean, it wouldn't even be discussed. It would be canceled and there would be no real reason for it. You know, I love this. I mean, if this is the new Axl, that's great because, you know, Axl's had a lot of problems. And I think he has some psychological issues, some emotional issues. But if he's overcome those and is going to get himself into the groove, so to speak, then it's great. I think it's great. I mean, I love Guns N' Roses, and I love AC/DC, so it's all going to be fine.
See, to me, this kind of mirrors Coachella. It's the beginning of everything,
right?
But once the stresses of the road kick in, long does this last?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and I mean, I don't, you know, I want to be optimistic about this, but it realistically, who knows? You know.
And I would pay $250.27 to hear the phone conversation between Dave Grohl's people and Axl's people. Like, hey man, I got this throne and I'm not doing anything with it now. Do you want to use it?
Do you think it's actually Dave Grohl's people though? That's the thing that, you know, because that would be what, John Silva?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't know if it's John Silva. I think it might have just been.
Or was it Dave?
I think it was probably Dave.
Axel's
I think it was
phone
Dave.
Number.
Yeah, I think Dave could probably get anybody. I mean, Dave sat down with the President of the United States. Like, Dave can get anybody's phone number.
Yeah.
He just never calls
remember,
me. He never calls me. He has my phone number, but he never calls
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Dave, be on the show.
Dave.
Let's chat. Yeah.
Dave.
Be our first guest.
Call me up.
But for those that don't remember, I think it was either the 1991 or 1992 MTV Video Music Awards. Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love got into a little altercation with Axl Rose, and he said something like, "You better shut your bitch up." And then when Nirvana played later that night, Dave Grohl got on the mic and he said, "Hi, Axl. Hi, Axl," and kind of mocked Axl Rose.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and but I gotta tell you though, like I have some experience with all of that, with Courtney and with Kurt and with other people who were around them. And I will tell you that a lot of that stuff is apocryphal. Like there was a story about Ian MacKaye where she said that he saw her backstage at a Fugazi concert and said to her, "You better behave." And he's like, "I never said that. I would never say something like that to anybody." Like, come on, that's ridiculous. So you never know about that kind of stuff. But there was apparently a little bit of a beef. Again, I don't understand these beefs. We've talked about this.
Well, also, Guns N' Roses wanted Nirvana to open for them.
Well,
and Kurt Cobain said, "No, we don't want to open for you."
Well, why should they? Why should they have opened for them? No, I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, that would have been a...
Well,
you know,
I mean,
a lot
for
of bands
you,
would love that
maybe
to
for
play
you,
a stadium.
That would have been something special. But I don't know. I mean, like, to me, Guns N' Roses and Nirvana existed in two separate worlds. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, hindsight is 2020, but, yeah. I mean, how many bands would have loved to tour with Guns N' Roses and Metallica in stadiums back in the early 90s.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Monsters of Rock. Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
Let's go.
A sad footnote to this story. Brian Johnson released a statement this week basically saying that his hearing is bad. He bears no ill will against his bandmates, and it appears that he will not be touring anymore.
Right.
Although he said he's still awaiting to hear what his doctors say, but he will do studio work. But it looks like his time with AC/DC is done.
Yeah, he said he could record, which of course he could. You know, it's a shame.
So
it really is.
We wish Brian Johnson the best.
Absolutely.
You got to read the letter because it gets you at times.
No, it does. I did read.
Where he says,
I did read it.
I'm performing in these big stadiums and arenas, and he's like, I couldn't always hear well, and I felt like I was dragging the product down a little bit.
Right. He was saying like he felt like he was maybe bringing the performance down because he couldn't hear.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
So a class action lawsuit has been filed against Kanye West in the streaming service Tidal.
And well, it should be.
Music fan Justin Baker Rhett alleges that Kanye West tricked fans into signing up for the streaming service Tidal, which costs $10 a month, by promising it would be the only place you could hear his new album, The Life of Pablo. Maybe it was Kanye's tweet, which read, "My album will never, never, never be on Apple.
Ever.
It will never
ever,
be for sale.
Ever. We're never,
you
ever,
can only
ever
get it
getting
on Tidal.
Back together.
So, Lyle, incidentally, The Life of Pablo can now be streamed on Apple Music and Spotify,
ever.
And it's currently for sale on Kanye's
ever.
Website.
Ever.
So here's the financial breakdown. It's estimated that 2 million more people joined Tidal just to hear Kanye's album, and with the value of new customers and new customer information, the stunt could net Tidal an estimated $84 million.
Yeah, that estimate is like, I mean, what does that mean, really? I mean, I know that it looks like Jay-Z's trying to sell Tidal, but isn't he also like suing the original investor? I mean, like, I don't... But let me just say this. I mean, the problem with this class action lawsuit, one of the things that we have in the society is we always bristle at these lawsuits, right? But one thing you have to look at is not just anybody can sue anybody. I mean, Jim, I can sue you tomorrow for some crazy.
You would crush me. You're a lawyer.
No. But I mean, I could just put.
I could just go
put a lawsuit in the Southern District of New York and just say, you know, Jim Shearer defamed me. But here's the problem. Here's the only problem with all this stuff. And what you have to look at, if you want to be intelligent about hating these lawsuits, look at what the damages are. What are the damages to signing up to Tidal for $10? Well,
right.
From where I sit, it looks like $10. And let me tell you, the filing fee is a lot more than $10. So you basically filed, and maybe it costs you, I don't know what the filing fee is. Maybe it's $100, whatever. You've basically gone 10 times what you're ever going to be awarded, because what's a jury going to award you? What are your damages? I mean, it's all fine and dandy to say, like, you know, hey, Kanye West screwed me, but exactly how and for how much money? And so I don't, these things don't.
Yeah, it made a nice internet story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful internet story.
I'm sure it's going to be settled before it ever.
I would think so. And basically, it's a phone call. I'm like, hey, you want $10? Here's $10. You know, bye.
I'll sign you a hard copy of The Life of Pablo, the only one that exists.
And we'll give you free title for the rest of your life. Or the rest of the time that it exists, whatever comes first.
Lyle, before we go to break, this story is from a couple weeks ago, but I know we both have an opinion on it. The Black Keys inducted Steve Miller into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then Steve Miller, after the ceremony, blasted the hall. You got to go on YouTube and check out his 2-minute blast of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He said they don't respect the artist they honor. They make it unpleasant. They need to change the system. He could only bring his wife. He couldn't bring his band. And if he wanted to get tickets for his band, it would cost $10,000.
Right.
Now, and it's funny too, because he actually shut down the press line. They said, "All right, we're done. We're just shutting this whole thing down now."
Right.
In lieu of his comments, the Black Keys said they regretted inducting him. They took time out of their own schedules, flew there on their own dime, and wanted the evening to be a celebration of rock and roll. As it turns out, the two parties didn't even know each other.
Right.
The hall handpicked the Black Keys for Steve Miller's intro, who later said he requested Elton John.
Well, I mean, this whole thing, I got to be honest with you, this whole thing just makes me kind of crazy. I mean, first of all, you know, I have my own feelings about the whole concept of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I think we've discussed a little bit, whatever. And I want to really be clear that I'm speaking for myself and not for anybody else in my band or whatever, because they have their own opinions. But everything I've read, and again, you and I are both, Jim, going by what we've seen and read. We don't know these people personally. I mean, you may know the Black Keys. I've never met them. I've never met Steve Miller. But everything I've ever heard about Steve Miller is that he's a good guy, and he's a decent dude. And
all right, let me stop you there. I know the Black Keys, and they're good guys.
Okay, so they're all good. Everyone's good. But what I have to say is that, you know, I knew when Steve Miller got nominated and accepted that there was going to be a little bit of an issue, because he made it kind of clear from the very beginning that he was not exactly enamored with the whole Rock and Roll Hall of Fame concept. Now, you have two choices. If you get nominated and you make it in, you can either show up and say what you want to say. Well, you have three choices. You can show up and just be gracious. You can show up and say what you want to say about it, or you can not show up at all. And those three things have been done by various people. He chose to make some statements about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I can't necessarily disagree with. I mean, they are his perspective. He called people jackasses, jerks, fucking gangsters, and crooks. And I can tell you that I've met all of them, all those folks, at some point in the record business. What I would say, and is he right? I don't know if he's right. I mean, everybody has their own experience. It's like, you know, if you are on a major record label, maybe it's the greatest thing in the world for you, and it may work out fantastically. And then again, it may be the worst experience of your entire life. There's no guarantee on any of that. As far as the Black Keys are concerned, there was two things that struck me. One was I watched the induction speech, and I thought it was terrible. It seemed to me as if they really didn't have any idea who they were even talking about. There didn't seem to be any passion.
Yeah, why were they there?
Right. I mean, it just was like, oh, you know, hey, and now I'm going to induct Bob Marley, man. You know, I mean, like, it was just, it didn't make any sense. I watched it. I actually sat through it, and it just seemed to me to be almost like reading off a teleprompter. It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, I don't even see the connection between the two of them anyway.
And so, by the way, I've been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony, and yes, the speeches are on teleprompter.
Yes, and I've been there too, and I've been to the Waldorf, and I've done the whole thing, and I've done it with Seymour Stein, who is, you know, continues to be one of the major players in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I have a lot of opinions about it, but they're not really worth a whole lot. The one thing that struck me, though, that, and the second thing that struck me was that for Dan Auerbach to later on make comments about it made no sense to me at all.
No.
And I mean, he said something that I thought was, well, first of all, he said, Pat and I were disappointed. Well, okay, obviously, everyone seemed to be disappointed. He said, I hope that when I'm in my twilight years, I can look back and be grateful to the people who have appreciated me and be able to give back. Because music is about sharing and passing on inspiration, and that was his opportunity, being Steve Miller's, his opportunity to do that, not lashing out in a way that was completely unfocused. Well, wait a minute. Steve Miller is on the board of Lincoln Center. Steve Miller has given back. He's done amazing things for, you know, for schools and music. Like, it just seems way outside to me.
But Steve Miller didn't lash out on stage.
Right, exactly.
It was afterwards in the
press
line.
And by the way, he also let them off the hook by basically saying, I don't think that we never met. They didn't really know me, and he let them off the hook. So for Dan to go out and then say something afterwards, I don't know. That's where I have a problem. That's exactly where I have the problem. I think that what Dan did was wrong. I think he should have just said, you know what? It didn't work out the way I wanted it to. And left it. And just left it. Because, I mean, it was obvious.
I love the Black Keys. We go back a long way.
I like
them
too.
But when I read this story, I said, really? I'm like, you didn't even know each other. What did you expect?
Right.
Well, that's why when I've gone to the Hall of Fame induction ceremony, when you see the presenters, a lot of the times you're like, oh, well, they're just there because they're high profile.
Right, exactly.
They probably don't even know this band. Like, Fall Out Boy inducted Green Day. I like Fall Out Boy. They were obviously inspired by Green Day.
Sure.
But they shouldn't have inducted Green Day into the Hall of Fame.
No, they shouldn't.
Not at all.
That's ridiculous for them to do that. You know, I mean, and also, but here's the other thing, okay, Jim. Everyone has a choice. It's like, if you call me up tomorrow morning and say, hey, Lyle, do you want to induct Nina Simone? Like, I'm going to go, no. I'm going to say, no, I don't think that's a good idea. And no matter how many times you tell me, well, you know, there's actually, you could actually, you know, you'd be really good if you did it, and you know a lot. No. It wouldn't be. It would be wrong. So maybe the Black Keys should have thought about that a little bit more. And I hate to say this, but it almost looks to me like they just wanted to be on stage.
It's ironic what they said, because they like, we took time out of our own schedules. We weren't paid for this. We paid for the airplane ticket. And I'm like, well, that's the problem.
Yeah.
I'm like, someone should be paying for your airplane ticket if you're going to present one of the inductees.
Well, there seemed to be
There's a flaw with the system.
There's definitely a flaw with the system. And I mean, listen, we can go on forever about this. I mean, the flaw in the system is, like, how in the world do you call this the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And you're inducting people who have absolutely nothing to do with rock and roll. And in many cases, they're dead and they can't even speak for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's fine and dandy to say, well, Miles Davis was, you know, he influenced people, but he wasn't a rock and roll musician.
Right.
He just wasn't. And so, and if we're going to induct him, then shouldn't we be doing Igor Stravinsky? I mean, arguably, he had more to do with talk to Metallica about Stravinsky. It's like, yeah, man, Rite of Spring, fucking fantastic. That bombastic, like, you know.
See, that's why I always compare sports and music, and
right.
I think sports has it right because they have a basketball hall of fame and a football
right.
hall of fame. They don't have a sports hall of fame.
No, because if you're going to do that, then you're going to be like, we're going to be inducted. And even sometimes even they get all weird because they'll induct people like, they'll induct like broadcasters. And I'm like,
yeah.
I mean, and not to say that those broadcasters aren't fantastic, but I mean, Vin Scully didn't ever pick up a bat and bat for the Dodgers.
Yeah.
He broadcast the games. And that's all fine. But again, the one thing that sports can do that music can't do is that sports can fall back on statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So they can sit there and they can say, you had a batting average of .325 for 10
mm-hmm.
years against this level of pitching,
yes.
and therefore you deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. You can't
you
do that.
You won four championships,
right.
yeah.
You can't do that with music, and that's why it's so ridiculous.
So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, Lyle is going to break down Stairway to Heaven in court.
The whole process needs to be changed from the top to the bottom. doesn't need to be this hard. There's nothing fancy going on out there that requires all of this stuff. They need to get their legal work straight. They need to respect the artists they say they're honoring, which they don't. I don't have any of my paperwork assigned. I have no licensing agreements with these people. They're trying to steal footage. They're trying to make me indemnify them. When they told me I was inducted, they said, you can have two tickets, one for your wife and one for yourself. Want another one? It's $10,000. Sorry, that's the way it goes. He said, I'm playing here. What about my band? What about their wives? What about... They make this so unpleasant that they came this close. They came, no, we're not going to wrap this one up. I'm going to wrap you up. You go sit down over there and learn something.
Hey there, everybody. Jim Shear with Lyle Presler. And right now, I'm going to play you a snippet of a song called Taurus from the 1960s American rock band Spirit. Sounds like Stairway to Heaven, right?
It does.
Huh?
It does.
I remember Lyle.
The first time I heard this was like maybe, I have to admit, I know Spirit, but I wasn't, you know, I'm not up on it. And Taurus is an instrumental track. And I first heard this a few years ago when this first came up. And I have to say that I did definitely see some similarities. And the interesting thing is, well, actually, go on, because it's more complicated than that.
So can you set up this whole story?
Well, okay, so basically the estate of Randy Wolf, otherwise known as Randy California, that was his stage name. Randy California, who was the guitar player, I believe, and singer and writer for Spirit, decided to sue Led Zeppelin over royalties from Stairway to Heaven. Now, Stairway to Heaven has made an estimated $562 million alone. I mean, that doesn't include, like, you know, the other songs or whatever. Now, because we're talking about 43 years ago, the only years that would be actionable, in other words, the only years they could attach if they were to win a copyright infringement suit would be 3 years. So most of that money is not in play here. I mean, they wouldn't get much of it.
Okay.
But you know, going forward, I mean... Stairway to Heaven is arguably one of the top five most important rock songs in history, whether you like it or not.
Yep.
Now, Stairway to Heaven was written and recorded in 1971. The Taurus song from Spirit was recorded in 1968. Now, one of the crucial things here is the fact that Led Zeppelin opened for Spirit in 1968 and 1969. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because here's how you prove a copyright infringement case, okay? First of all, you have to have a valid ownership, and we're going to get into that because that gets interesting. You have to have an ownership of a copyright. So in this case, Spirit is saying, or the estate is saying, we own the copyright to Taurus, and it was infringed. The second thing you have to show is that that work... Taurus was copied. And there's two elements of that. And one is access. Did the person who was supposedly infringing have access to the song? Now, let's go back and remember another famous copyright case, which is George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, which was ruled by a court to have infringed upon the Chiffon song, He's So Fine. And one of the reasons why George Harrison lost that lawsuit was because of the fact that He's So Fine was a huge hit. It was all over the airwaves, and there's no question that he would have heard it. So now Zeppelin is on tour with Spirit and probably heard Taurus. Now, I don't have any actual proof that they played Taurus at the shows, but it's a good chance they did.
See, if I was the judge, I would say, hey, was that on the set list?
Okay.
Right, if it's on the set list, exactly. And the other thing is you got to look for similarities. Now, we've already discussed, like, there are similarities. There's definitely an arpeggio there, a guitar line that sounds very similar. But let's move forward. So now we've got this case going on. It's going on, I think, in Pennsylvania, actually, which is interesting because, you know, it normally would be in New York or California or something like that, but it's in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Now, then somebody pointed out, and I want to give a shout out to a wonderful news organization called Digital Music News. And there's a guy there, Paul, who runs the thing, and he does a lot of great work, and they do great work. And a lot of people, if you want to sign up for it, you can get actually in your inbox every morning, you can get a little update, and which is where Jim and I get a lot of this information from. But someone turned up the fact that there was a guy named Davy Graham. Davy Graham was a folk musician in England in the 1960s. He's actually credited with sort of bringing back a resurgence of folk music in England. He was a bit of a savant, really, if you go back and you listen to his playing. And he wrote a song in 1959 called Cry Me a River, not to be confused with Justin Timberlake. He died in 2008, and Cry Me a... But if you go back and listen to the broadcast version of Cry Me a River, which was done on the BBC in 1959, boy, oh boy, it sure sounds like Stairway to Heaven. And Jimmy Page has already acknowledged over the years that he was deeply influenced by the picking style of Davy Graham.
Mm.
So there's a nut. So now here, what's the impact of that? Okay, well, here's the impact. Does that mean now that Spirit doesn't have a valid copyright? Because if they ripped off Davy Graham, then they don't have standing to be in a court saying that Jimmy Page ripped them off.
Mm-hmm.
They're out. It's done. So now, can the Davy Graham people, I mean, again, he died in 2008, but can the Davy Graham people come along and sue Zeppelin now? Would they want to? Who knows? But then it gets even weirder, because then somebody pointed out that in the 1660s, there was an Italian composer whose name was Giovanni Battista Granata. And he wrote a song called, and I'm going to get this wrong, but I'm going to do it, Sonata di Chitarra. And if you listen to that, or at least the recording that we have, we obviously don't have a recording from 1660. We have a modern recording of it. They did write things down back then. And if you listen to that, it's Led Zeppelin. It's Stairway to Heaven. It's the same arpeggiated piece. So now, if that's true, that work is in the public domain, which means that it's not under copyright and means that anybody can rip it off with no problem. So this whole thing has the potential, and again, Digital Music News, somebody pointed this out, this could blow up that entire court case. Because if
we can finally have Stairway to Heaven on Wayne's World,
we can definitely.
Because I don't know if you remember that when Wayne wanted to play Stairway to Heaven and they wouldn't let him, so he had to play some generic riff.
Right, exactly. And I would say there's a couple of, so in any event, what we've got here is the potential that all these cases can be thrown out of court, because all the Zeppelin people have to do now is go in and play Mr. Giovanni's piece and say, hey, you know what? We ripped this off. Now, here's the interesting thing about ripping it off. And if you recall, there's a famous quote from Pablo Picasso, good artists borrow, great artists steal. Okay? And that's what he said. And so, and by the way, both Robert Plant and Jimmy Page have said over the years that they have stolen riffs and stolen songs. Now, I want to be careful. I mean, that's what I get out of it. I mean, maybe that's not exactly what I'm saying. But they have done that, and so have so many people over the years. So if, in fact, Jimmy Page stole either from Taurus or from Cry Me a River or from... Mm-hmm. Sonata di Chitarra, he stole it. And does that mean anything? I don't know that it really does. I think it's fascinating, because I think the song itself is a fascinating song, and obviously it's been played to the point where most of us are kind of sick to death of it. It is, if you ignore your history with the song, it is a fascinating song. One of the more fascinating things about it, actually, that people don't really talk about is the guitar solo in it. The guitar solo in it is one of the best guitar solos ever written, in my opinion, but it's also not indicative of Jimmy Page's guitar soloing style. It almost sounds as if it comes from another place, which is fascinating because we're talking about Jimmy Page, who, by the way, during the early 60s, played on over 60% of all of the music coming out of England. Mm-hmm. He was a session musician. He was one of the most in-demand people. He could play anything. He could sight read. He could do all that stuff. He, and some people have suggested that he played guitar solos on some other songs that you might know, like The Kinks, You Really Got Me. The interesting question has always been, did Jimmy Page actually play the solo on Stairway to Heaven? Who knows? Mm. Because it doesn't sound like anything else he ever did. Now, he claims that it was divinely inspired. It came from either above or below, depending on how you want to, you know, interpret this. Did he sell his soul? Maybe he did. He lived in Aleister Crowley's house, which was purportedly built on the ashes of a church that was burned down. I don't think any of this is true, by the way, but that's what people say. Mm-hmm. So it just lends more fascination to the Led Zeppelin Stairway to Heaven thing.
Yeah.
And
how far does that go? Does the Italian guy steal it from someone?
Could be.
So, in related classic rock news, and also in related Coachella news, which we spoke about earlier, Coachella promoters are feeling out a concert event this fall, which would take place at Empire Polo Field in Indio, California. That is the same place where Coachella is held. The concert would be headlined by Paul McCartney, The Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, The Who, Roger Waters, and Neil Young. Negotiations are underway. On Twitter this week, I questioned if this would be the greatest concert ever or like paying to see old NFL legends playing a game of flag football. Well,
they're the sports analogies.
I know.
Here we go. Let me just say this, okay? I would be in favor of this if all of them would sign an agreement that would be it. Like, this is it.
Wow.
Like, if they would all sit there and go, you know how Motley Crue did that public thing where they signed, they said, this is it. We're not going to be Kiss. We're actually going to, this is going to be it. And so far, they've stuck to it. They probably won't, but they have. And so I think if all of those guys were to sit down and go, now, you know, the problem is you throw Neil Young in there, and I'm not sure that's really fair. But, you know, but if they would all sit down and say, okay, we're done. This is the end. You want to come?
Then that's a mega concert.
And that's a mega concert. And think about the rights. Man, you sell those, the video rights.
Yes.
You sell them for like unbelievable amounts of money. I mean, you'd have everybody competing for it.
So are you excited about this?
No. No.
Okay.
No,
I'm not either.
No, I mean, I don't see how you could really be excited about it. I mean, again, I would be excited if they would just say like, okay, this is it. You'll never see my ass again.
Yeah, I like that, Lyle.
Yeah, that would be great.
So I picked up my latest issue of Rolling Stone magazine with the Ramones on the cover, and I'm reading it, and they decide to list off the 40 greatest punk albums of all time. And I thought, wonder if Minor Threat's in there.
I wonder.
I had to turn a couple pages, man.
Yeah.
Minor Threat's complete discography is listed at number 27.
Well, there's actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I actually went to get my hair cut the other day, and the guy who cuts my hair said, oh, hey, wait a second. And he actually left a guy that he was busy, he was cutting the guy's hair, and he actually left. I was like, oh, dude, don't do that, man. I'm going to get in trouble here. And he goes and he pulls out the Rolling Stone and he throws it at me. And I read that, and it was, there's two things that struck me. Well, there's three, but the first is that I owned almost all of those records at some point. Yeah. But things like Wire, Pink Flag, I mean, that was just one of the records. You almost had to have it. You had to own it. Otherwise, you're not in the club. And the next thing that struck me was the fact that they use complete discography,
right?
Which seems to me like, so you're getting a best of, like,
right?
I mean, the best. I mean, it's really not a best of because it's everything. So it's not like, I mean, because we only wrote like 27 songs.
Yeah.
Or something. So I mean, it's like, you know, so it's not really a best of. We didn't cherry pick the best stuff. But that's a weird thing. And then the whole idea of ranking things is weird. But to be fair to the people who put that article together, and I don't know them at all, and I have no insight into it, but just in general, what I'd say is, like, you don't really rank things. You just sort of, like, agree on the 40 things or the 50 things or the 100 things. I mean, VH1 did it all the time, right? The 100 greatest rock songs. You know?
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, just because Prince, you know, Red Corvette is 97 doesn't mean it's, like, 97th. You know,
right.
It just means that we got to put a list together. So I think that that's essentially what they did, and they put together a list. And I mean, and the other thing, of course, is that they felt the obligation, which is understandable, to include things that weren't 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I get it. Like, you want to do that, and it's appropriate.
So, for those curious, the number one was the Ramones self-titled album from 1976. Number two was The Clash's self-titled album from 1977. Number three was Nevermind the Bollocks from the Sex Pistols. Number four was Funhouse from the Stooges. And number five was Entertainment from Gang of Four.
One of my favorite records of all time. Just absolutely. Yeah, the Gang of Four, like that record, I wore it out.
Congratulations
on being
number 27. So do you have any birthdays today, Lyle?
I do have some quick birthdays. I'm going to do an honorary musician birthday for Tim Curry, the actor who's 70 years old today. He was, of course, in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, played Dr. Frankenfurter. Dar Williams, a popular folk artist who was on a record label that I worked for, is 49 years old today. Elena Coates is 19. She recorded with the band We the Kings, who are actually have a song out right now that's doing pretty well. And this is kind of interesting. Eve Graham is 73 today. She was in a band called the New Seekers in England. They were in England, but she's Scottish. And she sang the song I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, which became the new Coca-Cola hit. And if you are a Mad Men fanatic, you know that from the final episode. So Eve Graham, happy birthday.
The number one single on the Billboard Hot 100 this week is Work from Rihanna featuring Drake for a 9th straight week. The number one album. I mean, it's a good song, but it's not 9 weeks at
it's
number
not
one
that
good.
Good.
No, it's not.
No.
The number one album on the Billboard 200, Cleopatra from the Lumineers. The number one song on iTunes, 7 years, from Lucas Graham. The number one album on iTunes, A Sailor's Guide to Earth, from Sturgill Simpson. And the number one song on Spotify this week, One Dance, from Drake, featuring Wizkid and Kyla. When we come back, Lyle and I will have our music picks of the week. Oh, yes. We're back. Jim Shear with Lyle Presler. Time for our music picks of the week. And I don't mean to talk my pick down, but I'm going to.
Okay.
It's not going to change your world. It's not a club banger. But sometimes I like to listen to music that's not necessarily a hit song, but it has a certain mood, and it takes me back to a certain place. So this song, it's from a newer band. They're called Witching Waves. The song is called Pitiless off of their latest album, Crystal Cafe. And when I hear it, it just takes me back to the 90s. Like, I can smell the must in a thrift store after I hear this song.
You can smell brownies.
So here is Pitiless from Witching Waves.
Yeah.
There you go. You know, it takes me back to a moment.
Well, I think so. It sort of like has that guitar figure that's a little bit Smiths-like. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's kind of that kind of thing. I mean, it's not Johnny Marr, but it's good. I like it.
So they're a trio from England. I like that their first album they released on a cassette, and this was in 2013.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, they're probably fascinated with what we did back in the 90s,
yes.
And hence that's why they sound like they're from the 90s.
They do indeed. And the only thing I think that I have, the only problem I have with it is that I think the recording's just, it's not a very good recording, which kind of surprises me because, I mean, usually English bands have really, really good audio.
Now, you have a two-parter this week?
I have a two-parter.
For your music pick of the week?
Well, yeah, because the problem is that, you know, I listen to a lot of pop music because I have a daughter, and so, you know, and I, she's, at this point, if I hear the Lucas Graham song another time, once I was 90 years old, and, you know, and if I hear that again, or 21 Pilots, or whatever, I'm going to go crazy. But there hasn't been a lot of new music. You were talking about the cyclical nature of releasing music. Well, we're sort of in that fallow period, I think, right now. There's not a lot of music coming out. But I did want to mention Alicia Cara. She has a new song called Wild Things. Mm-hmm. And so we can just listen to it.
Find table space to say your social graces. Bow your head, they're pious here. But you and I, we're pioneers. We make our own rules, our own room. No bias here. Let them sell what they are selling. There, no bias here. So gather all the rebels now. We'll rebel rouse and sing aloud. We don't care what they say. No way, no way. And we will leave the empty chairs to those who say we can't sit there. We'll find all by ourselves. So
I like Alessia Cara.
Yeah, Alessia, that's right. I can never get that. For some reason, I can't get the pronunciation down on that.
It's funny, when I heard her first single, Here, which I think borrows some from Portishead.
Oh, yeah.
I just think of this Amy Winehouse type of figure. But then when you see Alessia Cara perform live, she looks like a 9-year-old
kid.
She's like
10 years old or something. But what I've, and there's a great story about her, which, you know, is probably puffed up for consumption. But what I like about her is I don't hear, lyrically, I don't hear somebody who wants to be accepted. I hear somebody who wants to stake their own claim, which is what I like about it, because I mean, I gravitate towards that. I think that's great. She's not trying to be like every other girl of her generation. She's saying, in this song and in Here, she's basically saying like, hey, I'm my own person and I'm going to be my own person. And I really like that. And so that leads me to my throwback. Now, you know, Jim, and a lot of our listeners may know that there is a cult of the Replacements.
Mm-hmm.
The Paul Westerberg, the Replacements, it's a cult. I actually just got a new book called Trouble Boys, which my wife is actually quoted in because she did work on some of their later records. I like the Replacements. I'm not a fanatic, but you and I both know people who are, who are kind of insanely fanatical about them. I have some wonderful stories that I can't probably say on the radio because they would involve actionable things about the Replacements. I will tell you, what I can tell you is I saw them play 3 times and they were
horrible. I think I know where you're going with this.
They were horrible. They were horrible, 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 horrible. They were demand your money back horrible. I mean, they were so drunk that
I knew this, and I didn't know if you were going to go there.
Absolutely,
but I'm glad that you did.
And you know, but I will say that Bob, who died, was a wonderful guy, and he was the only person in the band. Sorry, guys, he was the only person in the band who was nice, who was interested, who actually even knew who I was, which was fine. I don't really care about that, but I mean, he did. And I was actually in a band that opened for the Replacements and at the 930 Club. I always wanted them to be good, and they were always bad. Now, people will tell you that they saw them when they were brilliant. I don't believe them. I'm with Joe. Joe Henry said the same thing. I'm with Joe. I think that they are fool. They were drunk. They were drunk, and therefore it seemed good. Or they were high, and it seemed good because it was always awful. All right, now where am I going? Okay. Where am I going with this? In 1992, Chris Marz, the drummer of the Replacement, released a record called "Horseshoes and Hand Grenades," which I love the title of, and he released a song called "Popular Creeps," and we can take a listen to that.
There you go.
Okay, so now Popular Creeps. And what I love about this is a song about Paul Westerberg. Okay. And a lot of Replacements fans don't want to acknowledge the fact that Chris Marz said, you know, the guy's a jackass. Okay. So what I love about Popular Creeps is that he says, and the line I love, I mean, all the lines are great, but the line I love is, they better leave us loners alone. And I think that is, and I think Miss Cara is saying something of the same thing in her songs. And so I kind of think they're connected in a way. I've always loved Popular Creeps. It's a great song anyway, but it's just wonderful that he's taken down Paul Westerberg. And I think that's completely appropriate.
And you totally just gave Alessia Cara some punk rock cred.
Yeah, I give her some cred.
That was an awesome spin right there, Lyle.
Okay, well, that's what I'm known for.
So we're going to take one more break, and when we come back, I'm going to play Ask Lyle, and I guess Lyle is going to have to play that too, otherwise it wouldn't make sense. Are back on the show with no name, although on the street, some people are starting to call it Lyle and Jim.
They're just calling it Lyle and Jim.
Yeah,
well,
there
that's
you go.
Good. No, I mean, I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah.
I mean, the good news about that is that when you want to break free from this, Jim, you can say, well, I'm on the Lyle and Jim show, or the Jim and Lyle show. And they'll go, oh, yeah, no, I know who you are. Whereas if you called it like the bed sheet show, then it would be like, yeah, there's this show called the Bedsheet Show, and it's got these two guys on there. And then that's too attenuated for our modern attention spans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you, Lyle, if you ever get any opportunities from this show, I want you to take it.
Oh, well, I certainly will.
I want you to leave me in the dust.
Okay.
Because I've been a fan for a while.
Well, I've been a fan.
And I remember listening to you as a guest on podcasts, and I'm like, this guy needs his own show. So if you ever get your own show, I'll still listen and I'll still be your friend.
Well, you know,
and I'll be fine with you leaving me behind.
You know, it's interesting because I did hear somebody who was part of a team talking about their breakup, and he said something to the effect of this idea, which I'm not sure I actually buy, but he said, you know, the closer the team, the more likely it is to break up. And I'm thinking, like, what? Is that really true? Like, I don't think that's really true. I mean, like, I mean, that's like, well, then Jagger and Richards should have broken up a long time ago. And they've tried. Now, they've tried, but they haven't succeeded. So I actually think that that's wrong. I think the longer that goes on, the more successful it is, the more that you are so bound to that person that you just ignore all the things you hate about them.
Okay.
And I think I'm being perfectly honest, not with regard to you, because I don't know you well enough to hate anything about you yet, but okay. At some point I may, you know, and so at
I
that
have something
point,
to look forward to.
Yeah, exactly. But don't you think that's more the case? I think it's like a marriage.
On to the questions.
Ask Lyle.
Lyle, I did reach out to social media.
Okay.
So you may end up hating me by the end of this.
I probably will.
Okay, I have a question from Brandon Murray.
Who is?
And he has.
Is it just a guy named Brandon Murray?
He's actually a friend of mine,
okay,
who loves punk rock music.
Okay.
He asked me this via Facebook. Mm. I don't know if there's a hidden diss in here somewhere.
Okay.
But here goes. He said, was the person at Caroline who was responsible for signing Uncle Slam fired or just humiliated for what they did? I'm not familiar with Uncle Slam.
Oh boy. Yeah, that's not ringing any bells.
Uncle Slam.
Yeah, it's not ringing any bells. I mean, the name sounds familiar. But I will say this, like, first of all, I was at Caroline Records for a very specific period of time, and sometimes people confuse it. Like, you know, I wasn't there for Smashing Pumpkins. That was before me. And
okay.
I wasn't there for Fatboy Slim, which was after me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there in a period, but Uncle Slam sounds a little bit familiar, and I'm now going to be in real trouble because the people are like, you can't remember that. First of all,
I don't know Uncle Slam either.
No one ever got fired for signing something. I will say that. Okay, I can make that definitive statement. No one got fired, because if I had been firing people for signing stuff, I would have fired all of them. Every last one of them. Yeah. No, I never did that. I never did it. I don't know if maybe my precursors or my successors did that. But no, I don't think so.
Now, from what I know about Brandon, he is very serious about his punk rock music. And as I'm looking on the internet right now, it says Uncle Slam, years active 1984 through 1995.
Okay, so
they were influenced by punk rock bands like Suicidal Tendencies, DRI, Corrosion of Conformity, Black Flag.
I gotta think that Uncle Slam was before me, because you remember Suicidal Tendencies was on Caroline. That was before me, way before me. I actually did not sign any punk bands to Caroline. I was not a player in the punk rock field.
Okay.
And I never.
So it seems like Brandon has issue with Uncle Slam.
Well,
Uncle Slam, if you're listening, take it up with Brandon.
Yeah, I think so. Or you can take it up with Keith Wood, who was my predecessor. You know, he might have done something. Who knows?
So my second question: American Idol just concluded. How often, if ever, did Lyle Pressler watch American Idol?
I can, without any question, tell you that I've never watched more than 10 consecutive minutes of American Idol.
Okay.
Never.
Now, within those minutes, not totaling up to 10, what do you remember from American Idol, if anything?
Nothing but that annoying British guy.
Oh, Simon Cowell.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
so you're not heartbroken that it's off the air.
I'm not heartbroken, but I am reminded of a story. And like, okay, do you remember? And this is the roundabout way in which I do this stuff. But do you remember the Bud? Was it Bud Light or Budweiser that had the party animal, the dog?
Bud Light, was it?
Was it Bud Light? Okay.
I think so.
So now let me ask you a question. If you're an executive at Budweiser, right? And these mm-hmm. guys come into your office and they say, "We want to have a new advertising campaign which features a dog and we're going to call him the party animal." Would you or would you not have thrown them out of your office? Because I would have. In fact, I wouldn't have only thrown them out. I would have called security to come get them out. Okay? And therefore, I would have missed a fantastic marketing opportunity unprecedented in the beverage industry, actually, except for maybe I'd like to teach the world to sing, buy me a Coke, right? So that's one element of it. Let me tell you how I get to the next, to the American Idol. I was in a meeting early on in the late 1990s, early 2000s somewhere, where there was an English guy who came in and he was pitching us on something. I don't know what it was. I don't remember. But he said, oh, you know, there's this thing in England called American Idol. Well, not, it wasn't called American Idol, obviously it's called Idol. But he said, there's a show, and I understand that they're gonna make it here in the United States. And I said, it'll never work.
Yes. I thought the same thing.
So this is why I'm not the head of a record label. This is why I'm not the head of a Fortune 500 company. This is why I'm not in advertising. Because I don't get it. So
yo, it was Star Search in prime time.
Exactly, it was Star Search, and it was like that. I remember saying to the guy, like, it'll never work. Never. He said, oh, there's this guy on there, Simon Cowell. He's like, he's a real big deal in England. It's gonna be a big show. And I was like, you're fucking crazy.
Even its logo. Like its logo looked like clip
but
art.
But how about that? Yeah. God, that drew me.
All right, final question. And once again, if any of you would like to ask Lyle a question, hit me up on Twitter or Facebook. Use the hashtag AskLyle. When was the last time you listened to a cassette tape?
The last time I listened to a cassette tape was probably... Oh, you know what? I do know. It was probably about 5 years ago.
Okay.
And the reason why I listened to a cassette tape is because I had a cassette player... I had a deck, and I wanted to see if it still worked.
Okay.
And it did, and then I threw it in the trash.
Wait, it didn't work?
It did.
It
no, it did. It was a Harman.
Then why did you throw it away?
It was a nice one too. It was a Harman Kardon. I remember buying it in the early 90s, and thinking,
well, why,
like,
did you throw it away?
Because Jim. I mean, at some point, you just, like, how many things can you put in your basement? Like, at a certain point, you just go, like...
Well, when you...
You know what the
when
greatest...
When you find that Sam Hain demo, you're going to have nothing to play
on. If I find that Sam Hain demo, I'll find someone who has the ability to play that thing. Because no one has that. But I will tell you, like, the greatest thing in the world is if you ever own a house and if you ever do any work on your house, they put a dumpster out there. The dumpster the dumpster is the most amazing thing in the world. Because all the stuff you could never throw away before... Now you just throw
yes.
it. And it's incredible. And you actually get to the point where you're actually looking around for things to throw away. You're like, can I throw this out? No, you can't throw that out. That's your nightstand. No, but you know, you actually go around looking for stuff. The last time I had something done, which was a few years ago, I threw so much stuff in there. It was just, it got to the point where it was like I had to be stopped.
Well, back to the question. Do you remember what tape you played?
Yeah, I think it was a live tape. I think it was like maybe SOA Live in DC or something. I just picked the first one I could find. I think it was SOA.
Okay.
I think, you know, it was when Henry was in the band, Henry Rollins was in the band. I think I threw that in and it worked. And I was like, oh, it works. And then I put it back in the basement and it kind of sat there for a while. And then the dumpster arrived.
I'm reading up on Uncle Slam.
Yes.
I'm kind of interested now because it said that they put out Say Uncle on Caroline Records in 1988.
Okay, so
which
that's
I guess
way
would've
before
been,
me.
That would have been, yeah. And Amory Smith, who drummed for Suicidal Tendencies and later the Beastie Boys, was a longtime member of Uncle Slam.
Okay, see, now it's starting to make sense. Since you put it in the suicidal camp, now I'm remembering. Like, but again, it was definitely before me.
Yeah, but on paper, I'm like super interested now.
Yeah.
So, Brandon, if you're listening, well, I'm going to listen after the show, and then when we come back, we'll have a report on Uncle Slam.
Definitely.
Yeah. We're going to actually take a vacation next week, but we'll be back the week after that.
All right.
So, yeah, work on your suntan, Lyle, and I'll do the same.
I will.
All right. For Lyle Presler, my name is Jim Shear, and we will see yens later.
So long.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has just left the building.